Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at ideas as they move from being unthinkable to plausible to policy and talk to the people who change what is possible in politics. Now, most of our lives are governed by the principle of voluntary association. Unfortunately, union policy is too often based on coercion. And to talk about that and what he's doing about it, we are joined by Gene Hamilton, a senior advisor with the Coalition to Protect American Workers, a new labor policy advocacy organization. Gene, welcome.
Thanks for having me on today.
What's wrong with union policy today?
Well, where to even start? Look, I think that one of the things that is emerging amongst the American people, or at least is being recognized, it might have been there all along, but in recent polling from Tony Fabrizio has indicated that the American worker is actually popular. Support for the American worker when it comes to right to work is an important concept. On the flip side, support for union leadership, the support for the union stewards and the folks who are in charge of making decisions and advocating for them is really not that great. And that's across the political spectrum. That's not just limited to liberals or conservatives or anywhere in between. What we're talking about is a widespread recognition that workers matter, workers' wages matter. People want Americans to have a better quality of life, but there must be something wrong. Something seems off in terms of what's been happening over the course of history to lead us to the point where we are today.
What do you think went wrong?
Well, I think that there's a lot of things that we could point to. And one of the most, if we could talk about coercion, we can talk about coercive methods of trying to get workers to join unions or to game the system, to do things other than use secret ballots to decide whether or not somebody wants to be a member of a union. So there's a lot of kind of coercive games and mechanics, a lot of things that have been done at the federal executive branch level, at the NLRB in the last administration, which, of course, isn't anything necessarily new, the shenanigans that they've been trying to play. But what happened over the last 4 years was really something fairly egregious. And so you can get into some of the, you know, kind of the micro techniques and tactics and some of the things that they've done to create advantages for the leadership of organized labor. But one of the things that I think that's really, really critically important is that just there's two points I would like to drive home. Mm-hmm. One of which is that when it comes to unions, when it comes to workers, when it comes to who's looking out for the American worker, there is a big difference in the messaging and the rhetoric that's coming out of the leadership of some of these big unions today, or at least over the last 10 years, juxtaposed against the rhetoric that was coming out of them from, say, 30 years ago on the issue of illegal immigration. Not legal immigration. We're not talking about worker people coming here on employment visas and the like, but illegal immigration. Where you had large unions for a long time who in the past took a strong stance and said, look, we just want to make sure that we're standing up for our members, or we want to make sure that the flood of labor supply is not coming in and undercutting wages. If you look around America today, you'll recognize that, in fact, it doesn't seem that any of the large unions are speaking out against anything or that they raised any kind of noise whatsoever over the last 4 years. So why does that matter? What does that have to say other than the fact of the matter of just basic supply and demand on economics and wage suppression, which is a really big and important thing? What it indicates is that a lot of these unions don't really seem to have the leadership of these unions have kind of lost their way. They've gone from advocating for their workers and things that advocate for better, you know, pay, better working conditions, better benefits, all the things that you might expect for a worker to do, and instead move to kind of a subscription model where that empowers the union, that empowers the union leadership to then use that money and take it and use it for their own political purposes for their friends. And if you just kind of pause and you think about that, you know, it used to be the case. I mean, even out in California, the Cesar Chavez, a recognized leader in the left, was very much a strong believer in the enforcement of the immigration laws when it came to workers out in California, out in the farm fields, and making sure that the influx of labor was not undercutting the wages and working conditions of union workers at the time. But now today, again, looking at in this, I use the term kind of subscription-based model. I mean, I like to think of it as kind of, you know, your Netflix subscription or your Disney Plus or ESPN Plus or whatever. What really helps these unions, the leadership of some of these unions, is just getting more dues. And so they've kind of lost their focus. They've lost their way, many of them, to advocating for things that actually help their workers towards, you know, taking positions that say, hey, is this going to help me get more dues in the door? Fantastic. We're going to keep our mouths shut. We're going to take this money and then we're going to use it to help ourselves and help our friends advocate for things that they like, but that don't necessarily improve conditions for workers.
So the way that unions, unionization is supposed to work, the American model, is that workers get together, they band, they hire an agent who represents their interests. That agent bargains with employers to give them a better deal than they would otherwise get if they were just on their own. And
yes,
theoretically, that deal that they make is supposed to provide certainty, clarity, etches out how to cooperate, establishes professionalism for the workers, and even possibly some greater respect as workers have some more rights under these collective bargaining deals that should help make those workplaces a little bit more productive. Okay. That sounds good and effective, win-win type of situation where workers can come out ahead and employers come out ahead too. But now I see unions lobbying for partisan gerrymandering constitutional amendments. Like, that seems like it would be something that at least some of their members don't like. So why do they engage in controversial politics if they're just supposed to be their members' agents?
You know, it's a really great question. It's a great point. I mean, when you look at the contributions from some of the larger unions over the last several election cycles, you see strong preference based on political ideology, not based on worker needs, not based on supporting things that are, again, putting the worker first. And it was a great description that you just provided, which is, you know, what is the role of a union? A role of a union is to, you know, in a sense, almost act as a fiduciary agent. You have a fiduciary responsibility to advocate for the needs of your members. And in the same way that a lawyer has duties, professional duties, to zealously advocate for their clients, kind of in the same vein, a union should have the same kind of mindset when they're going into it. I think that when you look at their contributions, though, you could look at the 2016, 2020, 2024 presidential election cycles. At least two of the major unions out there gave over 99% of their political contributions to the Democratic candidate for the president.
And that's unlikely just one example. That 99% of their members were supporting that candidate.
Exactly. So that's the thing. It's like, look, there's probably people who did support that candidate, and there's a lot of people who didn't. And so what should you do as a union leader in that type of a situation? Well, you think you would at least have more balanced contributions, or instead, maybe you wouldn't make contributions at all. But instead, they are just rallying behind this kind of their allies. that this really interesting dynamic for folks who spend any time around D.C. To understand kind of institutional capture, the way that things happen, the way that people make friends, And instead, it appears that in many cases, what is in fact happening is leaders of some of these unions are then advocating for things that benefit their political preferences, their political allies, who are trying to help do each other favors. And so they're supporting causes and positions and policies and laws and all kinds of things that the members either, number one, don't care about. To be clear, many people, many union members do not care about some of these things that their leaders are spouting off on. But secondly, that there's probably very mixed opinions about these issues. And so what they should be instead doing is trying to use their time and energy. Again, every human being, I don't care what area of the world you spend your time in, how you spend your day, everyone is limited by the clock. There's 24 hours in a day. Part of that day you're going to spend sleeping. Part of that day you're going to spend eating. Part of that day you're going to be spent getting ready from one thing to the other. And you have to you only have so many hours in the day to move the ball forward for whatever you're supposed to be doing. And so when you have somebody like some of this union leadership that's doing things on the side that do not, in fact, directly benefit or enhance or help the members, the workers, the American workers who do need, obviously everyone wants better pay. Everyone wants better working conditions. But they're, in fact, adopting these kind of radical positions and doing things that are undercutting their workforce. And that serves nobody's interest, because all that does is, in the end, it causes political hostility, political animosity, and also, in many cases, creates a lot of animosity with the leaders of the corporations or the companies in which the unions, the bargaining units, are, in fact, parts of. Instead of being collaborative and instead of working together and instead of being a good kind of reasonable advocate for the union membership and having a seat at the table, this type of conduct is eventually going to lead them to be more and more ostracized and pushed to the side. Of course, there are laws that govern what they what they can and can't do and what employers can and can't do. But you ultimately would think that a good union that advocates for workers, that advocates for better pay, and that has a seat at the table would want to do those things and wouldn't go off and chase and spend all of the money out of their membership's pockets. Now, again, that's, another key point that I think everyone should understand at this point is that it's not as though these unions are necessarily, out there providing their own goods and services, and they're bringing in their own money on the side. These are dues coming from the members themselves. And so, again, you have a fiduciary responsibility. You have some kind of responsibility to be accountable to people when you're taking money out of their paychecks to use it to enhance the conditions and the benefits for those workers.
I want to dig in on this a little bit, because it does seem like this the model of unionization is not working the way that it's supposed to. How did it get to the point where unions tell their members what to believe instead of representing what their members believe?
I think that there's we can trace back different moments over history, right? I mean, the NLRA,
the National Labor Relations, Private Sector Unions.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we're going back nearly 100 years, 90 mm-hmm. years ago, this thing was initially passed. There's been iterations and kind of evolving norms that have ebbed and flowed as American society, as the American workforce has changed from the early 1900s into where it is today in the year 2025. And what's interesting to note about that is that not some of it was traceable, I think, is fair to say, is traceable to actual shifts and changes in the actual American workforce, from a more kind of, folks working in warehouses and manufacturing things to a type of a workforce where a lot more people are in service industry jobs and other things. And so there have been some dynamics that have been, I would say, influenced by actual real changes in the American workforce and in the American economy But a lot of it is just driven by political dynamics and political control and ideology. And certainly that was the case over the last 4 years and under the Biden administration with the NLRB, with different changes that were made there. And again, what does this have to do with anything? You have people, partisan actors, really. I mean, that's the best way to describe them. Partisan actors who are trying to work under the confines of within the bounds of existing law, trying to say that some plain black letter law says something that it doesn't, try to twist and turn little procedural mechanisms to tap into the workforce, to get their bargaining recognized, to file unfair labor practices without any basis in fact or law. And just generate a lot of work. They raise a lot of hubbub. They cause a lot of problems because, in fact, what it has been creating is more political power and political leverage for the leaders of the unions and not for the members. And so, look, I don't know that there's anything that's necessarily traceable to any one particular impetus or one particular organized event, other than to say that there's a culmination of practices over the last 90 years, culmination of different changes throughout society. And ultimately, with a lot of these organizations, it's once you make political allies, at least historical political allies, with people with kind of, I would say, more extreme agendas, then once you become friends with them, they're going to expect you to continue to carry out those kind of extreme agendas. And instead, what you're seeing now today, I hope, and I think the polling I described earlier seems to indicate some of this, is a little bit more bipartisan recognition that looking out for American workers is good. And you have this new package of bills that was just introduced by the Senate Help majority, that recognizes that protecting American workers is actually a good thing to do. There are structural changes that can be made. There are adjustments that can be made to existing law to ensure that as we head into this, 21st century, with the advent of things like AI and robotics and a changing economy and all kinds of things, that labor law is set up in such a way to ensure that the people who are benefiting from labor protections, the people who are benefiting from the structure, are in fact the American workers, who then have an actual choice. They're not coerced into anything. They're not misled by one side or the other. They're in fact put at the center point of the workforce, and they can make decisions based on the facts that are presented to them from union leadership, from the employer. They can decide in secret, confidentially, like we do on election day, in political elections. They can decide whether or not they want to be members of a bargaining unit, whether they want to form, whether they actually even want union representation, whether we're going to talk just about a portion of a workforce or all of the workforce. There's a lot of kind of, I think, structural changes that can be made that seem to be recognized in this recent legislation from the Senate Help Committee that could be advantageous to producing the kind of world that we want. I haven't had time in the last 24 hours to pore over every single line, but what I see in them at the kind of high level is promising. And so in the interim, what else do we need to do in the year 2025? Well, we certainly need to get appointees confirmed to the NLRB so they can have a quorum, so they can continue to actually...
Do they not have a quorum, though?
We need a real quorum, a quorum that it reflects the views of the president, the views of the 3-2 membership that is set up by law, and that allows the NLRB to take certain actions that are consistent with the president's agenda and to course correct some of this bad policies that were created in the Biden administration.
All right. So you've got legislation you like. You've got administrative action you want to see. What are you doing about this issue?
So I think that one of the main things that we are doing is educating. We are trying to educate. We're new on the scene, fairly new. We are trying to educate people to understand that the American worker is supported by conservatives, by the Republican Party. And you can see that here in this legislation, from this legislation that's been advanced by the Senate Help Committee. But not enough people understand the issue. Not enough people understand kind of what's been happening, what's at stake, and what's coming ahead. And so our role, at least as of right now, is to help educate and to help get the word out about these changes, about these regulatory changes, these administrative changes that need to be made, and then about potential legislative changes that need to be made. So initially, the key to any kind of societal systemic change oftentimes starts with education. And so that's what we're trying to do today, is to educate and to make sure that we're reaching people from all facets of society, from all facets of the workforce. It's not just like a DC oriented thing. This is the type of organization that we want to reach out to the American worker. We want to educate people who are confronted with these issues in their workforces, make sure that they have the tools and information available to make educated decisions about what's right for them in their workplace, to make sure that that relationship between the employer and the employee is a healthy one, that is not disturbed, that is not contaminated by people who are in union leadership, who are trying to advance their own agendas instead of doing what's in the best interests of their workers. Really recognizing and reaffirming that the Republican Party and conservatives kind of across the board are the party of the worker, of the working American, in making sure that labor law, in making sure that labor policies reflect this understanding that it's not going to be an area that's dominated solely by liberal ideologues who want to advance a certain cause because it's politically expedient and it gives them more money from union member dues to advance radical causes, radical legislation, radical policies. You would think that a union would, in fact, want to, again, very, very simple, spend their members' dues, spend their time, spend their advocacy on things that are directly related to their members' needs, advocating for better pay, advocating for better working conditions, having a seat at the table when we're talking about this new influx of technology that's coming into the American workforce. How do we make sure that we're all prepared and that we use it as a force multiplier and not a replacement? How can we make sure that we use modern tools and technology, AI, robotics, all these things to make the American worker more productive, to have a larger economy, to make things even better for everybody? But one thing that we can be sure that we will not have going forward is a seat at the table if employers are completely pushed off to the side, their preferences are pushed off to the side by union leadership who's advancing political ideology that the members don't even agree with.
Mm-hmm. So you're trying to educate voters, educate the American public, get your message out there. You're not a media company, though. How is the Coalition to Protect American Workers going to get its message out?
Yeah, so it's going to be more and more media interviews, podcast appearances, newsletters.
So this letters to the editor.
Strategy. Yes. Yeah, so it's really one of these, just like you would do with any kind of campaign, is working on educating policy makers, folks on the Hill, the American workers across the board, getting the message out there and spreading it wherever you can through as many different fora as you can to ensure that people understand the stakes. I mean, again, this is an area where there are a lot of entrenched feelings. There's been a lot of people doing good
and
work.
Interest.
I'm sorry?
a lot of entrenched feelings and entrenched interests.
Yes, exactly.
As we've talked,
there's a lot of parties, a lot of great organizations like yours that have been doing a lot of good work in this space for years and years and years to educate people and to highlight some of these emerging issues. And it's really to help complement the good work that is already being done, and to take it to another level, to just to keep the conversation going and to reach more and more people, so that everyone, every American, every employer, every employee understands the stakes that are in front of us as a country in the year 2025.
You mentioned that you guys have worked with an agency to do some polling on this issue. What does that do for you? How does that help you out?
So I think the polling helps to highlight the importance of some of these issues that we are highlighting. And for example, it's one thing for me to come out on a show and say, well, you know, we're the party of the American worker. Believe me, trust me, I know what I'm talking about. And it's quite another thing to have polling that's done independently that backs up exactly what I'm saying. And that shows the American, that shows that in fact, we're not alone. This is not just us who's out here saying this. We are making statements and we are educating and we are taking actions that are based on things that are actually popular with the American people. And so some polling can be questionable depending on the source. This is one of the best pollers across the country. And this is indicative information that is a great launching point that helps us understand where the American people are now and how we can extrapolate and how we can position ourselves to make sure that we are advocating again for the American worker in the most effective manner going forward.
Yeah. By the way, for listeners, a good way to tell whether polls are high quality or not is if you actually get to see the wording and the responses. Don't just trust the people who are telling you what a poll is going to say. You can check it out. We live in the modern era. Most of this stuff gets posted online, and if it's not, there's a reason for it. I assume polls are also going to help you with the legislative or administrative action that you want to see, which is to go, not only do we have a compelling message, not only do we have a compelling argument, but it's the kind of thing that the American people want. You should be more comfortable with this kind of thing, even if it's going to upset some partisan interests.
Absolutely. No, well said, very well said. Look, it's... anyone who spent any time on working on Capitol Hill, I've certainly done so, understands sometimes it's hard to get things to move unless you can show leadership, unless you can show members of either the Senate or the House that something is, in fact, very, very popular. It's going to help them with their constituents back home. And so polling is always very helpful for that. And of course, then on the flip side, when it comes to administrative action, it's also helpful, not always necessary, of course. Sometimes you have to do what's right by the law, whether or not the American people, you know, are wildly supportive of it or not, especially when it comes to carrying out the executive functions of the executive branch of the federal government. Sometimes you're constrained and you're bound by the contours of existing federal law. But understanding kind of the peeling back some of these radical Biden administration policies that took place over the last 4 years are things that are going to, in fact, be popular, not just the right legal interpretation, but that are going to be popular and supported by American workers and in turn by their representatives in the legislative branch, which, of course, is always helpful and conducive to ensuring that we have good government.
What should people expect on this issue over the next couple of years?
I think that we're going to see, we'll see how things change with this particular legislation. We will see what administrative changes are going to be able to be made by President Trump's appointees on the NLRB. Hopefully we see more protections put in place for American workers We see more transparency provided for American workers in terms of the operations of unions, in terms of understanding where their dues are being spent, what causes their hard-earned money are going to advance, ensuring that there is fair and balanced information presented in all circumstances so that the American worker is put and able to make an educated decision. So from there, I think you'll see a lot of things potentially start to shift and change. Of course, you're going to see a lot of, if things work in the direction that supports the American worker, you're going to see a lot of gnashing of teeth and wailing and agitation from people who have been benefiting from the system over the last couple of decades here. And the people who are benefiting from it, again, are not the members of the union. They have been the union leaders and their political allies who benefit from being able to take these dues and use them for whatever causes that they want. But I think that especially as we see the intersection coming here with the advances, as I mentioned, with AI and robotics, and we see a changing dynamic in the American economy. What with, you know, obviously people you talk about the gig economy and, you know, what the workforce looks like in the future. We don't know today what the workforce is going to look like in 10 years. We can make predictions. We have a good, pretty good ideas. But ensuring that at the heart, at the center of anything, whatever comes next, whatever lies ahead, lies the best interests of the American worker when it comes to labor unions and labor law. Not, look, you know, there's always going to be some natural tension between employers and employees. That's normal, that's healthy, and it's completely and totally fine. But
and
ensuring
it's what
that
we want our labor law to help accomplish so that we can get right to an agreement that's that works for both sides.
That works for both sides, exactly.
Yeah. All right, G. Good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.